I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, more clashes in Egypt even after a state of emergency is declared. The Arab Spring proves to still be a work in progress.
These are rumblings, long-term rumblings, but not yet radical change.
The U.S. position on Iranian sanctions and marking International Holocaust Remembrance Day. It's all ahead. Anti-government violence continued to flare in Egypt today, even as President Mohamed Morsi declared a state of emergency in three regions along the Suez Canal. VOA's Elizabeth Arrett has details from Cairo.
Protesters defied the imposition of emergency law in Port Said, Ismailia, and Suez, vowing to continue demonstrations and battles with police. Many in the political opposition have also rebuffed the president, saying they would not take part in his call for a national dialogue to help ease the tensions. Mohamed El-Baradei, who heads the opposition Dostur party, spoke at a news conference Monday afternoon, even as violence flared in the capital. The Nobel Prize winner said opposition forces are ready for dialogue, but not a dialogue, he said, that they know will just lead to a dead end. The violence began last week as Egyptians marked the second anniversary of the revolution, then erupted after a court sentenced to death 21 people, many of them Port Said residents, for their role in a deadly football riot last year. The unrest nationwide shows deep divisions in the aftermath of the uprising. The president enjoys the support of the Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamists, but other Egyptians complain of a deteriorating economy and a failure to address such questions as social justice. The wrath of many taking to the streets is focused on the police. In Port Said and elsewhere, fans, known as ultras, have long been suspicious of Interior Ministry forces, which they accuse of excessive use of force and lack of accountability. Political activist and prominent blogger Wael Khalil says that there are numerous sources of discontent, but the overwhelming cause of the current unrest is anger at the police, which he says has remained unaccountable for decades.
This is really an intact institution of the old regime, and it's continuing, and now it seems like Morsi and the Brotherhood are embracing it as their own.
Khalil says that imposing emergency law will not solve an underlying problem of police impunity and the anger it provokes, adding that until the president addresses the issue, he's just harming himself. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Cairo.
As Egyptians mark the second anniversary of their revolution, experts are assessing the actual impact of the Arab Spring, which some people expected to transform the Middle East. VOA's Al Pessin reports from London.
The Egyptian revolution was a time of great hope and enthusiasm among millions of Egyptians, but the second anniversary finds secular liberals protesting what they see as excesses by the new Islamist-led government. The contrast is emblematic of the disappointment and conflict that followed the euphoria of the uprisings in Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, and other countries.
The word revolution is a very romantic term.
Stacy Gutkowski is a Middle East expert at London's King's College.
It conjures up images of something dramatic like the Berlin Wall falling. That isn't what has happened in the region. These are rumblings, long-term rumblings, but not yet radical change.
Gutkowski says many people were bound to be disappointed, even where governments were overthrown. And the kind of dramatic change the North African countries have seen has not spread to other parts of the region, where activists face either lengthy violent conflict, as in Syria, or piecemeal changes meted out slowly by entrenched autocracies, as in the Persian Gulf states.
To say that there is one Arab Spring is really a misnomer. In fact, there are three Arab Springs.
And considering the different types of governments and variety of local cultures in the vast region, that's not surprising. Certainly not to the former British ambassador to Libya and Iran, Richard Dalton, who spoke to VOA via Skype.
The Arab awakening was always going to be the work of a generation. It's not a surprise that there are different rates of change, but nowhere in the Arab world has the population been untouched
Not only is change slow and uneven, in some cases it's in the wrong direction, as people deal with issues that the former autocrats covered up, like economic problems that have made life worse for many rather than better. There are also concerns about the rights of women and members of minority groups. And while the region's new leaders are being tougher on the West and Israel, the autocrats' pro-Western policies have not been changed as dramatically as many had hoped.
Whatever government is in power, countries have interests, and there's a narrow range of options for maximizing advantage to both government and people.
So whether in the presidential palaces or in the streets, 2 years later, the Arab Spring is still very much a work in progress. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
Women's World Banking, a microfinance network, has been researching women's financial needs in Egypt and the changes that have taken place since the revolution. Mary Ellen Eskandarian, president and CEO of the organization, spoke with us by cell phone while on the road.
Women's World Banking has been very specifically focused on some of the issues around women's economic empowerment, women's entrepreneurship, and we've seen with the really dramatic impact on employment, negative impact on unemployment, particularly for men. We've seen a lot more women coming into the marketplace, by their own admissions, not necessarily by choice, but by necessity. Although when they're getting into the marketplace, establishing businesses, they're actually finding considerable success. And so, we're very excited to see that. But what we were also concerned about, and part of the reason behind our getting involved, was at the request of our partner in Egypt, the LEED Foundation, which is a microfinance organization serving a large population there, was the fact that these women's businesses were really not able to access the capital that they really needed to grow.
What are some of the reasons behind that?
The microfinance model that's traditionally thought of in many places is one where a group of people will come together and borrow, very often counter-guaranteeing each other's loans. And that's been a very effective way to bring people who've never had any financial access into a financial relationship with a financial institution. But what it doesn't do is allow a business to get the right amount of capital to allow it to grow. Essentially, you're limited by whatever amount of capital your neighbors feel comfortable guaranteeing for you. And in Egypt, we've seen a really strict divide between women almost entirely having their businesses financed out of this group model, whereas men have been more easily able to access individual loans from microfinance institutions. So loans that were at a financial institution would look at a business's ability to repay and then make a sort of right-sized loan that really allows the business to expand. And that opportunity has pretty much been denied women in Egypt. And so now as you're seeing more women coming into the market, you're seeing their businesses grow. There's a real need and frankly, an exciting opportunity for Egyptian financial institutions to step into that market.
Is this an area where the international community might step in with some financial assistance for the women?
Well, certainly you've seen the financing for microfinance institutions to in turn lend to women has become, it hasn't dried up, but it's become a lot more difficult to get as Egypt has seemed like a riskier environment. For many, many years, USAID was pretty much the backbone of the Egyptian microfinance industry and financed a huge percentage of that business. And then a few years ago, they stepped out of that business. And so now for those institutions to have to find alternative sources of capital. So I think there'd be a very welcome move on the part of the industry to having more capital readily available. I think one area that some organizations, including ours, have been working is to provide training to the women so that in addition to access to finance, they would have a better understanding of access to markets, marketing, basic business bookkeeping and accounting skills, all of that is an important part of helping those women's businesses grow.
Mary Ellen Eskandarian, President and CEO of Women's World Banking. U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says last year's deadly attack on the U.S. mission in Libya's eastern city of Benghazi has prompted her to take urgent steps to improve security at diplomatic posts worldwide. In the Benghazi raid, suspected al-Qaeda militants on September 11, 2012, attacked the Benghazi compound, killing four Americans, including the U.S. ambassador. At a recent Senate hearing, Secretary Clinton said she has responded to the violence by asking for hundreds of additional Marine security guards to be sent to vulnerable diplomatic posts. She said she also appointed an official to the new position of Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for high-threat posts, with responsibility for giving missions in dangerous places the attention they need. Clinton said she has designated more than 20 U.S. missions around the world as high-risk sites requiring tighter security. Nicholas Kralev is author of America's Other Army, the U.S. Foreign Service, and 21st Century Diplomacy. He tells VOA's Michael Lippin existing restrictions on diplomatic travel already have made life difficult for the diplomats.
Many American embassies overseas are accused of being fortresses because they look terrible with high walls and fences. And, you know, takes a long time for people to go through security to enter. And once upon a time, I think I was in London when someone at the embassy said you used to be able to just go up the steps of the embassy and enter the building without going through security. But obviously, that time is long gone. But I think in addition to security, what I think most people don't understand is that there are restrictions. There are security restrictions on American diplomats, meaning, you know, in many countries they're not allowed to go outside the capital. And diplomacy in the 21st century is not done in buildings and behind walls and fences on by phone and email. So before the Benghazi attack, Hillary Clinton, in fact, had tried to push diplomatic security, the bureau, the arm at the State Department that deals with security, to find a better balance between obviously the need for security, but also to give American diplomats a better opportunity to actually go and do their job. Unfortunately, after the Benghazi attack, I just don't see how this can happen now that the focus is much more on the security part of this, and clearly it'll weigh much more heavily than the other part of the equation.
Who exactly is imposing these restrictions on
State Department
on diplomats, and where are those restrictions applied?
In many countries where it's deemed that it's not safe for American diplomats to travel outside the capital, they're banned from going. In some countries, they may get a waiver of that. They have to request written form permission to go outside the capital. In some countries, there are areas, not the entire part of the country outside the capital, but specific regions. For example, for years in the Philippines, in the southern Philippines, American diplomats have been not been allowed to go because of terrorist activity. And so I don't believe you can even get a waiver for that. It's just a no-no. And I'm not saying that great diplomacy could have been done in the southern Philippines, but, there are other countries like that. And clearly Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, there are American consulates in Pakistan outside the capital in Karachi, in Lahore, in Peshawar. But there are also restrictions of where people can go. And look at Baghdad. Do you know that American diplomats stationed at the embassy in Baghdad are not allowed to actually go in and have dinner at an outside restaurant, meaning outside the embassy compound? I think they told me that there are like two restaurants on the list that where American diplomats actually or embassy personnel are allowed to go outside the compound. And that's it too. Baghdad is millions of people. It's a huge city. And seriously, they're not allowed, besides these two restaurants, they're not allowed to go outside the compound and have dinner or lunch or whatever at an outside restaurant. They have to stay on the compound. And so in the movements of American diplomats, there are these restrictions, and they affect how they do diplomacy. They do.
Nicholas Kralev is author of America's Other Army, the U.S. Foreign Service and 21st Century Diplomacy. Iran says it has successfully launched a monkey into space. Defense Minister Ahmad Vahidi told a state television that the monkey returned alive after traveling in a capsule to an altitude of 120 kilometers. The report gave no details on the date or location of the launch. Tehran's last attempt to put a monkey into space in 2011 failed for undisclosed reasons. The country's space program deeply worries Western nations, which fear it could be used to develop ballistic missiles that could potentially be armed with nuclear weapons. Sanctions have been put in place to try to pressure the government not to develop nuclear weapons. But are these steps having the wrong result? Nigar Mortazavi of VOA's Persian News Network interviewed David Cohen, the U.S. Department of Treasury's Undersecretary for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence, who is considered the architect of sanctions. She asked him about U.S. policy regarding sanctions against Iran and recent reports from inside Iran on the shortage of medicine across the country.
Our sanctions policy is part of a broader U.S. policy with respect to Iran and, in particular, Iran's nuclear program, where we have been offering the Iranian government the opportunity to negotiate in a good faith, serious manner about its nuclear program on the one hand. But on the other hand, so long as the Iranian government is not fulfilling its international obligations, is pursuing its nuclear program, we will use sanctions to increase the pressure on the government so that the choice is very clear between engagement in addressing the international community's concerns with Iran's nuclear program on the one hand versus increased pressure on the other hand. So the sanctions are designed to put pressure on the government, not on the people of Iran. We have no quarrel with the people of Iran. And as a result, for many years, our sanctions have been designed in a way to exclude from the sanctions, so to permit trade in food, in medicine, and in medical devices. We do not have any sanctions on any company or any financial institution that engages in trade in food, medicine, or medical devices. What we focus on our sanctions program in particular are those who are involved in helping the Iranian government develop its nuclear program, not on the trade in food and medicine. So the ultimate objective here is to try and slow down the development of Iran's program, its nuclear program, and to put pressure on those senior officials in Iran who are responsible for making the policy judgments with respect to its nuclear program, not to make food and medicine more expensive or scarce.
So you speak about the exception to food and especially medicine, but the reality on the ground, what we see when we talk to people especially, is that there's a shortage of medicine, especially for some kind of special disease such as cancer or MS, medicine for that kind of stuff. Why do you think there's a shortage?
Well, I've seen those reports, and, this is something that we are following closely, that we care about. We're not looking, as I said, to cause those sort of shortages. But I've also seen reports that the health minister, Mrs. Dasjerdi, was removed from her position recently because she highlighted the fact that the government of Iran was not funding the health ministry in anywhere close to the amount of funding that had been promised. And so as a result, the health ministry wasn't able to purchase the pharmaceuticals that the health ministry was looking to do, that the hard currency that they needed wasn't being allocated to the health ministry. Instead, the hard currency is being allocated by the government to other purposes, whether it's supporting the Assad regime, supporting terrorism, supporting the nuclear program. Those are choices that are being made by the government in Iran, and that's having an impact, I think, on the ability of the health ministry to do what it needs to do to import pharmaceuticals into Iran.
People see sort of a parallel of the mismanagement of the government, which you just mentioned an example of, and the pressure of sanctions, specifically the financial and banking sanction, the effect that it has on all kinds of trades with Iran. But the mismanagement part, the government's mismanagement, is not something that's new to the Iranian government, at least from the viewpoint of the people. They say the government has been there, has always had mismanagements, has had incompetencies from the eyes of the people. But the sanctions are what are new, and since the sanctions came into effect, there has been specific reports of the shortage of medicine. So how do you think, as far as these two parallel or go?
Well, I think you're right. The mismanagement of the economy is a long-standing problem in Iran, and I think responsible for some significant portion of the weakness in the Iranian economy that we see today. Specifically with respect to pharmaceuticals, I think it's been a long-standing problem, but the episode that I just described with the health ministry is a relatively recent example. So I think this mismanagement, can build on itself and can create greater problems in Iran that is sort of above what had been sort of the baseline level of mismanagement that has been in place for many years.
David Cohen with the U.S. Department of Treasury. Holocaust survivors, politicians, and religious leaders marked International Holocaust Remembrance Day Sunday with solemn prayers and warnings to never let such tragedies happen again. Events took place at sites including Auschwitz-Birkenau, the Nazi death camp in Poland liberated on January 27, 1945. At least 1.1 million people were murdered in Auschwitz, mostly Jews. Israeli officials warned that hatred still persists. Yuli Edelstein is the Israeli Public Diplomacy and Diaspora Affairs Minister.
Unfortunately, even 70 years after the Holocaust, we still witness more anti-Semitic deeds in different countries. We still witness a higher level of violence. And what is really disturbing, we see political parties running on neo-Nazi or ultra-nationalistic platform and making it into parliaments in different European countries. So we have not only to worry about it, but to act in order to prevent the future developments.
Pope Benedict warned that humanity must always be on guard against a repeat of murderous racism.
Cari fratelli e sorelle, ricorre oggi la giornata della memoria.
Dear brothers and sisters, today is Holocaust Memorial Day in memory of the victims of Nazism. The memory of such tragedy, which hit so harshly mainly Jewish people, must represent for all of us a constant warning so that such horrors of the past will not be repeated. Every form of hatred and racism has to be overcome, and respect and dignity of the human being be promoted.
U.S. President Barack Obama vowed to prevent genocide while honoring the 6 million Jews and millions of other innocent victims whose lives were tragically taken during the Holocaust. This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.